From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The days are longer and the light is strengthening. Triggers that don't just start to wake up our plants indoors and out, but also get us gardeners going. The signals have my propagation mad friend Ken Drews starting more seeds each week and looking around the landscape and the houseplant-filled sunroom for some chances to make more plants, his favorite pastime. More in a moment about how to do that yourself, but first these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Programming and underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, now offering 100% organic vegetable, flower, and herb seeds for that farm and garden. Available at highmowingseeds.com.
Ken Drews is author and photographer of 20 garden books, including one on plant propagation, and is a daring plant propagator himself. Together, since 2021, we've co-hosted the Virtual Garden Club, a series of online classes about our favorite subject, plants. Ken gardens in New Jersey, mostly in the shade. Hello, Ken, over there in the shade.
It's a little dark, Margaret. How are you?
Oh, I don't know. What season is it anyway this year?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally disoriented since the beginning of the whole winter and since the beginning of the year especially.
I know we talked about it, but 4 weeks ago, I cut the ratty, awful foliage off the hellebores and no flower buds were showing. And now they're in bloom.
And so now you're saying that as we're recording this in late February. And so you mean a month before that. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. It's completely crazy. And same here. I've never seen anything like it. And then it's 4 degrees and then it's 62 degrees.
Well, yeah. And you're not kidding. That really happened.
Oh yeah. No, I went minus 14 and a week later, 60, you know, so like, or, you know, 57 or some crazy thing. I mean, it's just nuts, whatever. Anyway, so that's getting us kind of looking around the garden at kind of opportunities for making more plants, as your book of about 20 years ago was called. And also, like, again, as I said in the introduction, I mean, I'm noticing in my house plants, it's like some of them were even ahead of schedule. It's weird. It's just so weird out.
Yeah, but I love it when the daylight hours start lengthening and the plants always know, even the plants under lights that aren't even near a window, they know. Some things that I've tried to propagate from cuttings, you know, like a begonia or something, they just rotted and were horrible, but now they want to wake up.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of what are some of the things that you're eyeing around the house or in the cellar or wherever you have things stashed or awake or whatever?
I can't believe what a busy time it is. And, you know, in mid-March, March is kind of the last time for major pruning. So I've been doing some things like that outside. And because you encouraged me, I did some experimenting.
Uh-oh.
You know, the bald cypress, it's called bald because it's deciduous. It's a conifer, like a pine tree, except it drops its needles.
Right.
And I cut it back right to the trunk because it sprouts from the trunk every year. And it was supposed to be this really little dwarf and now it's 15 feet tall. So I thought I'm going to make a column. So I did that. And that's kind of scary. It's not exactly propagation, but I know you and I are digging up our Euchomus bulbs, or I am anyway.
Well, and so when you say digging up, they're in pots,
right?
Where do you keep yours in the winter, these pineapple lilies?
In a cold part of the cellar that goes down to, probably coldest it goes to maybe 20 for a couple of days. But usually it's about 30 to 40 degrees. Yeah. And I'm going to dig them up and divide them if they can be divided, you know, if they have little side bulbs, and repot them because they slowed down on their blooming, and I think they just need a little refreshment.
Yeah, I find with the pineapple lilies that they make a lot of offsets. And so when I take them out of their pots, like what you're saying, when they slow down, what I find is if I then unpot it the next season after a disappointing bloom, there's too many bulbs in there. You know what I mean? It's just like too crowded. Right. And so I've started doing it like every other year, like making it more systematic when they're confined to pots. Is that, you know what I mean? Rather than wait till they fail a year. I mean, they always make beautiful foliage. Well, I don't, yeah, it's just, and they always make beautiful foliage anyway. So I like them anyhow, but yeah. So that's a good idea actually to sort of get on that now, that sort of dividing and making, you know, and if you don't have room or use for the extras, give them to friends, you know, but it's a good idea to do that now because when spring happens, there's not going to be time for any of this. It'd be good to check some of these things off the list.
Such
now.
A list.
Yeah. No, I know.
But we should say that pineapple lilies are called that because the flowers look like pineapples. They have little green leaves at the top of a long, tall flower spike.
Yeah.
We love them. They're so easy and beautiful.
Yeah, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. And, you know, it just makes for like annuals, quote unquote, you know, things to put in your containers that you don't have to buy every year and are unusual looking. And as I said before, the foliage is nice. Frequently it's freckled or speckled with like splashes of purple. Some are all purple foliage. And then even the stems sometimes almost look like spots of an animal's pelt.
No, I was gonna say
leopard.
Know?
Yeah, they have that like that animal skin kind of look, that spotted leopard look. So
and people
quite
in
wonderful.
Warmer climates can grow them outdoors.
Yeah, like zone 7 and so forth, a lot of them. Yeah. So
there's a lot of things that as soon as the ground is workable outside and not too wet, I'll be digging them up and dividing them. You know how they show in books two spades back to back prying apart a plant? I never do that. It seems to damage them. So I usually dig up the whole plant, put it on a tarp, take my dedicated serrated knife and cut them apart. So I'll do that if there's a congested hosta or if I just want more of that hosta in another place, kind of an echo. I'll dig it up and cut it in 2 to 4 parts as long as each part has a growing point or an eye. And, you know, Siberian iris, the middle of them die. So every like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I have to dig those up. But then you don't get 4 plants, you get 24 plants.
Yeah. And really that donut hole in the middle is dead stuff and you throw that away. Right. Yeah.
And the whole outside stuff slows down the blooming and everything.
Yeah. And you know, I again, if there's time, because this is a freakish year in a lot of parts of the country, weather-wise, if your late winter allows you to safely be going around outside, if it's not either snow-covered or slippery or mucky, where you're going to damage the soil, getting a jump on some of these things, like we were just talking about, you know, we think of dividing, and so we're both in the Northeast, and so we think of a lot of time doing that in, you know, April into early May and so forth, but by then you have foliage pushed up and you have flower stems or this beginning of them pushed up, and moving the thing without damaging it is harder. So you're saying, go ahead, be brave, do it a little earlier. It's not like we're going to have a deep freeze, 3 feet of frost to the ground again or
right.
something in
as
March.
As long as you know
whatever.
Where the plant is and maybe if you've marked
right,
it and
right,
thought about
right.
it. But so you can divide things that have come up and you can even cut some things back and divide them later, but it will affect the blooming. So, you know, if you dig up the phlox when it's 12 inches tall and cut it back to 6 inches, it's going to still live and it's going to bloom. It'll be shorter and it'll be later. But I'm just saying because... you shouldn't just give up because you're getting a little behind, I would say.
No, not at all. But on this end of the season, again, not when the ground's still frozen and not when it's mucky forth. But as soon as you can, it's okay to go around and like when you're planting those peas, it's okay to go around and look and see if there's a few things that might be ready to divide, you know, a little earlier than usual, right?
Or move.
Right. Right. Not that
I've got
I have
a
anything.
List of things that I do. I have
I'm teasing. I have like 2,000 of them that need anything. It's horrible.
Things I'm moving a dwarf hydrangea paniculata that has red flowers, and I'm moving it across the garden to a place where there's a red leaf peach and some other red things. So I'm moving that for aesthetic reasons.
Right. So it's not because it's too big for the space or whatever. It's a design choice. Right.
Right.
Right. So what other things where, you know, we were talking about like the bulbs, the and actually I have other bulbs or bulb like things in storage in my cellar. I have a lot of what do they call them, voodoo lilies, Soro Matum, and other crazy or Amorphophallus and so forth, crazy things that
stinky things,
stinky, and they some of them are awake. They're all, if I leave them in their pots, they like wake up, you know, in January, February sometimes, and I'm like, uh-oh, don't do it, don't do it, don't bloom, it's gonna stink, right. It's gonna smell like a dead animal in the basement.
And then you have to give them light when they start pushing their leaves after that.
Yeah, but anyway, so there's other things that I have stored that are going to be divided and, quote, making more plants, like you always say. But what other things are you kind of looking at eyeing for sort of propagation projects now?
Well, we can talk about seeds in a few minutes, but okay. I mentioned the begonias, which is kind of a softwood cutting. They're not even wood, but this is sort of the end of the period for hardwood cuttings, which are cuttings from woody plants like shrubs, and they're made when the plants are still asleep. And I think the last ones to make are cuttings from willows. Some people do dogwoods too, but you know, those twig dogwoods,
yes,
and the willows that we grow, either pussy willows or willows with colorful
sort of
foliage.
Shrubby ones, right.
So before they leaf out, which is kind of mid-March usually
where you are, yeah,
right, I'll take nice size cuttings and I just put them in water. Well, if you cut your pussy willows for decoration, don't put them in water because they'll last for months. It'll last for a year and look good. But if you want to propagate them, put them in water and they'll start making roots in the water. Willows do. But you want to try to transplant them into some kind of medium when those roots are less than an inch long and still white, because when they get a little longer than an inch, they either get tangled or worse, they rot. So you do it kind of young. And if you fail or if you only get 50%, you're doing okay. I've never gotten 100%.
Yeah. A friend came and took a bunch for her flower farm a few years ago of my various twig willows and twig dogwoods and so forth. You know, to eventually grow and sell the colorful stems in arrangements and so forth, because they're so fabulous. And, you know, the thing about it is if you want to do smaller cuttings, you have to remember which side is down, so to speak, right?
Definitely. Sky side up, earth side down.
Because they won't root the other way.
That's right.
It's kind of amazing. It's kind of wonderful, you know, to know that it knows. Again, speaking of the intelligence of all these creatures.
Well, that's funny. We were talking about euchomas, and I make euchomas leaf cuttings. And when I cut the leaf into, I'll take a leaf and cut it into four parts. But I take a marker and I make an arrow for the sky side.
Oh.
Because if I turn it over, same with like mother-in-law's tongue, Sansevieria, they won't root if they're upside down.
Right. So that's another one, houseplant wise, that we could be looking at making more plants of, huh?
Well, yeah. Later, when the euchomas leaves are out, you may remember I did that for a sale at Wave Hill, for a plant sale, and I think I had a dozen plants from leaf cuttings in a year. It was great.
That's really, and you know, it's not something that I would have thought of doing. And so I remember seeing that, but I also remember seeing your pictures of, you know, you'd have, again, with the proper side down in the moist medium, you know, and like this little creature formed on the top.
There were clusters of bulbs.
It was the weirdest thing. It wasn't, I don't know what was going on beneath the soil surface, but it was like these like little bulb piles were miniature teeny weeny, like babies were being born on top of that leaf cutting. It was nutty. It was really nutty.
That's the really, really exciting part of making more plants. I mean, when something like that happens, well, when you can nurture a plant and watch it grow and you're part of it, it's just thrilling.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you want to tell me about are you doing anything with any of your house plants or what?
Well,
what
it's kind of early. I looked around and I might be dividing some of the I guess there are alocasias that haven't gone dormant, and sometimes they'll make little side shoots, and I will cut them apart and pot them up. But it's a little early for me to make more herbaceous cuttings than things like begonias, things that are pretty easy. But in a couple of weeks, I'll be doing more.
So that you were talking about the elephant ears that we grow, like almost these tropically looking creatures that we grow, and some of them you overwinter almost like houseplantish.
Exactly. And the begonias are ones that have stems. They're not like Rex begonias or rhizotomous begonias that creep. Ones like angel wing and fibrous begonias, they're pretty easy. And I
And
try,
what would
yeah,
you
go
be
ahead.
doing though with those? What like so if I had a sort of upright kind of begonia, I had this one big one. Honestly, I had it only like 2 years. I don't even know what its name is. I got it at, the nurseries in one spring of a couple years ago. And it turned into this like shrub. I mean, it was like this massive thing, and there was no way I could fit it anywhere, And I thought, okay, well, what are you gonna do? And in the fall, I got it back. I cut out some of the stems and I kind of brought it in, and don't the damn thing is waking up and being happy, and it's going to be fine. It'll probably be a shrub by the end of the year again. But
Yeah,
that wasn't very scientific.
well, I
So
do that in the fall with some things like coleus. I'll cut them back and then take that new growth and root that mid-March. But with the begonia, you sort of said it. If you've got a begonia that's gotten really kind of woody and lost its leaves, I'll make a cutting to have a new plant, a juvenile plant, because a lot of them look better as children. And then I attempt to discard the rest of it.
And you
Which
fail, and you don't have the heart
often
to
I
get rid of
fail.
it.
No, that's why I cut that taxodium outside. I thought, is this cruel or is this horticulture? That's what I ask myself. Because a lot of people would think it's torture.
So with the piece of the begonia, so let's say we have this begonia and it has these upright stems, and so if we took one and we would you like first root it in water a little bit, almost like that willow you said, like just so it gets slightly rooted, and then put it in medium, or what would you?
Well, it sort of depends on the plant, but I think if it's mid-March and if there's new growth starting, I'd probably take a cutting of a tall angel wing. I'd take maybe a 3 or 4 inch cutting, and I'd put it in something like moist perlite. And
Maybe put a little plastic wrap
exactly,
over
I was
it,
just
like
going to
make a little
say,
hood, like a little
or slip it
terrarium-ish.
into a plastic bag that's open. I leave it open. Or in a terrarium that's an old aquarium that's open. You want to have humidity if you can have it.
But not rotting, not soaking, like
Not when I close stuff up. I know people do it, but things rot for me, so I always like to leave a little bit of, air circulation.
I had this I never had this before. It's such a common house plant, the Tradescantia, the sort of this, I think it's a briner or something, it's sort of like purple on the underneath and striped on the top, and just this, and the poor thing, I had just gotten it as some filler in a pot, in a annual pot. I used it, and I didn't have the heart, big surprise, to throw it away in the fall. But it just looked like, I mean, this is just like a week ago, it just looked like, I mean, I couldn't even believe it was still alive. Like some of the pieces hanging way down, cascading over the edge, they were attached to what looked like dried up wire. You know what I mean?
Well,
And
I
yet
do.
they were still alive. And I'm like, what are you doing? It's like you're on 6 inches of dead looking stuff, and then you're alive down there hanging down. So I took those live pieces and I, did a glass of water and, kind of stripped them down and left a few leaves at the end, and put them in water. And I thought, well, I'll try, what the heck, I can use it as filler in a pot again. So that's when you said the thing about the coleus. Is that what would you have done with that? You said you
Well,
had
right. The
propagated them.
things like coleus, I can't think of a lot of things. Some things that we get in the garden center or that we're growing and they're decorative outside, we put them in pots. And then what do you do? And so I usually bring them in and put them under lights, actually. So I'll cut them back to like 3 inches. And then this time of year, they start to push new growth.
And so you use that as your
I
like
use
stock
that, right?
plant
Because then
for
they're
cuttings.
young, new, juicy growth that's going to root very easily.
And okay, and you rid it in water, or you put it right in that medium again, like you were just saying with the other
under
thing?
The lights where it's humid, I'd do it in the medium right away. But that Tradescantia, you could probably grow it in water for 5 years, but then it'll be quite a mess. I like to get them into medium when the roots are not too
as
long.
Soon as possible. Okay.
Because they get all, you know, tangled.
So, you know, before we run down on our time, I just want to make sure that we get to some seed things. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've taken all my packets and I've arranged them by the date that they should be sown. And I've written on the seed packets, or even some seeds that I've saved and put in envelopes. And, you know, the way I do it is I get a 3.5-inch plastic pot and I'll do each kind of plant in its individual pot. I don't like do them in a flat together. So all the tomatoes will go into one kind of tomato will go into one pot and another kind of tomato go, very soon, I guess mid-March, go into another pot. And I'll fill the pot first with the medium and fill it all the way to the top and then press it down with an immaculately clean other pot and fill it almost sort of to the top. And I put the seeds around and then I cover them with a little bit of medium so that they're sort of covered with a medium equal to their thickness. So it's not much. I don't bury them. And if the packet says that the seeds need light to germinate, then I don't bury them at all. I'll do them on the surface. But on the surface, I sprinkle granite grit on, which is what the rock gardeners do. On all the pots, I sprinkle a very thin 1 to 2 grain layer of granite grit because it's inert and the medium won't dislodge it even when you're spraying water on it if you have to water it again.
Right.
And since I've been doing that, which is like 20 something years now, I haven't had the series of fungal diseases that's called damping off where, you know, the seedling comes up, it looks great, and then all of a sudden the next day
it drops dead.
Heals over.
Yeah.
But the granite really helps. And then when they're larger, I'll transplant them. And the other thing that you do is you take those seedlings outside. And I'm going to try that this year if they're not too heavy.
Yeah.
Because I think I've left them on the heat mat too long.
Well, the key with, you know, it's no accident really that the mat is technically called a germinating mat or a germination mat. It's for germination. It's not for growing. And so, you know, in a laboratory environment, you know, or, you know, is only used for germinating, or in, you know, agriculture, it's only used for germinating. The minute you see any growth, that thing has to come off. It doesn't mean then that they want to be cold. Mm-hmm. The room, the ambient temperature still has to be whatever that plant needs. You know, a tomato needs warmer than a lettuce or spinach or whatever, or broccoli, but it means that they don't want that cooking of the soil, that bottom heat that's going to stretch them out like too little light would stretch
them out.
That's
just what it does. It stretches them out.
Yeah. So we should just say the granite grit, this is this sort of poultry grit, and you can frequently get it at a place like a Tractor Supply store or whatever. You can even get it online, but it's expensive to ship. But it's kind of looks like birdcage gravel. So it's little, and there's different sizes of it, but yeah, granite grit.
It comes in three grades, and if you can only get one, get the starter grade, which is the smallest. It's like very coarse sand, and granite's good because it's not alkaline, and you want one that doesn't have any additives, which is available, that you can find it, and not oyster shell, because that's really calcium.
And sand is a possibility, not beach sand, but, you know, clean.
Yeah, as coarse as you can find it.
Yeah, clean, sharp sand. I mean, that is another possibility. And I know other people who use that in propagation, you know, as their sort of top dressing, their mulch, their thin cover of the seeds, as you described.
Yeah, I don't use vermiculite. Some people do, but I don't use vermiculite for anything.
Yeah.
That's another story.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's really important besides the hygiene that you were just talking about, well, is good light, not a windowsill environment, but proper light.
Right.
And then also, you know, the, you know, you were talking, I've lost my train of thought.
Well, you were talking about light, and it's funny because it's changed so much. I have the seeds. Well, when the seeds are in the pot, I think they're probably the top of the pots are like 4 inches from the light. It's a lot of light. And yes. I used to have fluorescent bulbs and tubes, and they were hot.
Yes.
So that's another problem.
Yeah, these new LEDs don't emit so much heat, which is great, because then hardly that can also stretch that can also stretch out the ceilings.
Right.
But I remembered what I was going to say, which is that you were describing this sort of community pot where you take one variety of tomato and you put it all in one pot to get started. And so then when those show their first little true leaves, and so it's like it might be 10 of them or 20 of them seeds. Mm-hmm. It's not like one tomato seed in that 3.5-inch pot. And then when they are far enough along, they start to show their first true leaves, you prick them out, you take out those seedlings and give them each their own little cell or pot, depending on what the plant is and what it needs
next. And no longer on the heat mat.
right. So that I just wanted to double back to that, because we're not saying that you start with a million 3.5-inch pots where you wouldn't have enough lights or heat mat for, you know, to get anything started. It's sort of this community of each variety. And then those are potted on to their slightly larger quarter, each individual plant. But so, of course, we've, you know, used up our time, and we haven't made that many more plants. But I've got to go down to the cellar now and see the Euchomus and tell them you said hello.
You do.
Yeah. All right, and I'll talk to you soon, and I'll see you at the Virtual Garden Club before long.
Thanks, Margaret.
All right, bye-bye.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Programming and underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, now offering 100% organic vegetable, flower, and herb seeds for that farm and garden. Available at highmowingseeds.com.
And I hope I'll see you all again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy making more plants meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.